Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility of a military confrontation between China and Japan over a dispute involving small uninhabited islands. Scott Savitt, a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International, joins us to discuss the economic fallout already experienced due to the growing tensions between two countries with the world's second and third largest economies. Then we'll assess the likely repercussions from a federal judge's decision to allow the enforcement of the Show Me Your Papers provision in Arizona's controversial immigration law that the Supreme Court recently upheld. Jeff Biggers, the award-winning author of the new book State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream, joins us to discuss the impact that Arizona's hot-button immigration law might have on the November election. Then finally, Hannah Rosen joins us. She's a senior editor at The Atlantic and the founder of Double X, Slate's women's sections, and the author of a new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. We will discuss the twilight of the patriarchy as a result of the revolution that feminists have been waiting for, which Hannah Rosen argues is happening now before our very eyes. Joining us now is Scott Savitt, who's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. His forthcoming memoir is about his two decades as an American reporter in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Savitt.
Thank you.
And there's a possibility of a military confrontation between Japan and China over these disputed islands which are uninhabited. And with naval ships sort of wandering around in the neighborhood, little wonder that U.S. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, visiting Beijing, has expressed his concern that things could get out of hand. But what's already happened is that the world's second and third largest economies, because of this dispute, are already suffering. So this could actually turn into a huge problem.
Oh, yeah. It's scary.
And what's your sense of what's driving it, and secondly, what could restrain it?
Well, something interesting is, you know, now I have a little perspective. I went to China as a teenager to study. So 30 years ago, these anti-Japanese protests started, and they've just been going on periodically. It's very interesting because people try and argue now, oh, this is something the Chinese government can't control. That's nonsense. This is very much being stirred up by people behind the scenes. You know, what their objective is more difficult to know. And that's the reason that the Japanese just stay very quiet and these things blow over. And it looks like the Chinese government already started giving a signal to put on the brakes today. They basically just open up the steam vent, let people go out and blow off steam in a safe direction against, you know, their nemesis, the Japanese, and then they just go back to business as usual.
Well, how much is this being orchestrated by a faction within the government because of the Maoist posters and all of that? You get the impression.
Well, the Mao is different. See, carrying Chairman Mao, that was done in Tiananmen in 1989. That's a rebuke of the president. Governors of China, because Chairman Mao was the great revolutionary that these guys just couldn't hold a candle to. So by holding up posters of Chairman Mao, they're telling their present leaders, you know, this was a real leader. And it's so important to understand these are all shadow plays and, you know, including putting people out on the street. Yeah, it's most likely it is some kind of factional jockeying, but only very, very inside. I mean, I have high-level contacts, and these things are so convoluted that even on the inside of the Communist Party, it's not that easy to know everything that's going on behind the scenes. But presumably, you know, if you say, who does it benefit, this is hardliners saying, you know, we need to be tough on all fronts. You know, unfortunately, China's actions in the South China Sea have, or the South Sea, as they, you know, the other countries like to call it, it's really backfired. I mean, by bringing the United States in, you know, to basically state unequivocally that we will honor our military alliance with, you know, not just Japan, but several of these countries involved. And it's China, they've really painted themselves into a corner with, well, that's the view of a lot of scholars or, you know, knowledgeable people that I talk to.
Well, Scott Savitt again, a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. This has followed, of course, the so-called disappearance from public view of the vice premier, Xi Jinping. He's, of course, resurfaced with Leon Panetta. Panetta, of course, is in a difficult position because the U.S., as you mentioned, has the treaties with Japan in particular, but also extensive trade with China, not to mention the fact that China subsidizes our standard of living by continuing to buy our debt. So there's quite a dance going on here. I guess the real question is, as crazy as it sounds, over these uninhabited islands that apparently belong to a Japanese family that were then the government of Japan just bought, or at least the Tokyo prefecture just bought, and now that's caused the sacking and the looting of shops and burning of factories, etc., in China. I guess the real question is, what confidence do you have that this can be restrained? If somebody's stirring the pot, and I imagine it might, as you mentioned, it's probably conservative circles or even military circles, what's the countervailing restraint there? The civilians still have control over the military, do they not, in China?
Yeah, I mean, presumably. You know, just a couple of details. So, you know, they're not just fallow rocks or nobody would be doing this. There's probably significant oil deposits, and that's what this is really about. So that's the first thing. And the second one is, I have great confidence that it will be reined in because I've watched it happen so many times before. Really, if you go back and look, this has been a regular occurrence, you know, every few years for the past, we always say 3 decades because that's basically the period of the post-Mao economic, you know, that's when the economic reforms started to take root. So everybody that does this has seen, you know, this is on a larger scale. They're playing with fire, you know, the Communist Party leadership. You let this many people go out on the street, and who's to say that one day it doesn't, you know, start turning against them, which is why there's such large police presences. And, you know, I've been told that the government even provides the eggs being thrown at the Japanese embassy, and that wouldn't surprise me at all.
There have been reports that patriotic businessmen paid for buses to bring people from the provinces.
Yeah, it's always the case. You know, this happened, you know, okay, so when I was a foreign correspondent based in Beijing, I had to live in the diplomatic compound with, you know, all the foreign diplomats, you know, except the ambassadors would have residences. So I live next door to the American embassy, and when the United States bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999, they basically, they brought the buses, they gave them the buses, they brought the students, and they basically walked by and they handed them all a rock and said, here, throw it at that building, the U.S. Embassy. I mean, as orchestrated as possible. And then, you know, then at a certain time, which looks like it's happening now, they turn the spigot off and say, you know, go back to, and obviously things that they don't want protested do not get protested in China. I mean, you know, not without a violent response from the security apparatus. So, you know, that tells you what's going on behind the scenes. I think that it's a sign of desperation, to be quite honest. You know, it's very difficult for the Chinese Communist Party to continue business as usual. You know, apparently they rule by committee, and I just think that's increasingly difficult to do in these modern, you know, information societies. So I think this is a sign of things to come. And, you know, everybody talked about them handling this leadership transition that's coming up smoothly. I mean, this isn't what I would call smooth.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Savitt, who's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. His forthcoming memoir is about his 2 decades as an American reporter in China. Now, when you say that things aren't behind the scenes, that things aren't working out well for the leadership in transition, obviously much was made of the so-called disappearance of the heir apparent who has now reappeared. But there's also the trial, of course, of Bo Xilai's, the police chief involved in covering up the murder of the British businessman. Those trials, of course, are highly orchestrated by the party. What's your reading? Because I know you know a lot of dissidents over there. What's your reading on how the public views the party following all of these scandals?
Oh, you know, my view has been since they basically had to come in with you know, tanks and troops in 1989 and, you know, carry out a massacre in the heart of their capital. Basically, their legitimacy has been based on the ability to kill people. And, you know, if you really allowed Chinese people to express their will, I don't think that these are the people they would pick to lead them. So, you know, we'll see how this turns out. But this is now the fifth generation leadership. And, you know, the Soviet Union didn't survive past a fifth generation. And it's getting very difficult. The guys who are coming into power now, they, for the first time ever, no personal military experience. And it looks like the Bo Xilai case was the first time that somebody said, hey, wait a second, you know, I'm going to go off the reservation. And that's the kind of thing that I think that you're going to see more of in the period to come.
Meaning what, Scott Savitt, that the country will break up into economic fiefdoms?
No. I mean, you know, the best model is how it happened in the Soviet Union. You know, you had a Gorbachev, but then, you know, ultimately you had a Yeltsin. And, you know, it finally the fissures within the party came out into the open. And that's long been my prediction about China, because that's what took place in 1989, is that, you know, you do essentially have, you know, you have a lot of patron-client relationships, but you basically have a, you know, a hardline faction and a more reformist faction, and they've managed to, like I say, rule by committee. But, you know, challenges will inevitably come, and, you know, where you had a Yeltsin standing off against a, you know, a threatened military coup. This, all these kinds of scenarios are very, very possible in China. No, it doesn't mean the country breaks up. I mean, that's not inevitable at all. I mean, the economy essentially runs itself. It, you know, this party stuff is almost grafted on the top. So you could make big, important national decisions, which they're, you know, this rule by committee, by most accounts, doesn't do very well.
Well, the fact that the world's second largest economy and third largest economy are loggerheads, and already there's been a dip in the Japanese share prices for Nissan, which fell 5%, Honda dropped 2.5% just over these disputes. And the world, in effect, it depends upon China's economy growing, and it's shrinking because of this. You know, the markets in Europe are drying up because of the euro crisis, the tremendous overcapacity. And my understanding about the Chinese government is that they really got to keep these economic growth rates up high in order to keep everybody satisfied, to keep a lid on what's bubbling over.
Sure. I mean, you know, that's the pressure that they have. And, but this just goes to show that if, you know, but people used to say, oh, they'll never do this or never do that because of economic interests. Economic interests take a far, far second place to what's going on politically. And, you know, this kind of thing of, you know, you could start to tease out some kind of objective in whose interest is it to harm, you know, economic growth numbers at the leadership transition period. And, you know, who knows if that's not some part of the motivation. But this is a little bit of a hiccup. I mean, you know, the economic performance, China's facing, you know, difficult structural reforms. I'm talking in the economy right now that are also completely separate from this. So the bigger issues never go away. But yeah, I mean, you know, it is playing with fire to let this man. And, you know, I don't know if you saw, but what just happened is the mob, because the Japanese embassy is right next to the American embassy, and the U.S. ambassador, his car was surrounded and damaged by the protesters. So that happened today, and you know, that's a little scary. You know, what happens if the U.S. ambassador gets, you know, something happens to him in China? Then what do we do?
So, Scott Savitt, you mentioned Tiananmen, which you witnessed back in 89, and that came about because of a split between the hardliners and the reformists led by Zhao Zheng, and actually the whole student occupation of Tiananmen was in memorial to Hu Yaobang, right, who was a revered progressive leader, along with the president at the time, who was also very progressive. And are there any people like that in the mix now? Is there a...
Yeah, there are. I mean, what's interesting is actually it's the children of the people who were involved, well, some of the same individuals. You know, the outgoing premier right now was the party general secretary, Zhao Jiang's secretary at the time, top staff person. And the son of Hu Yaobang, the person whose death sparked the 1989 demonstrations, he's playing a very prominent role. Basically, it's you could say that the leaders in 1989, they started the market economic reforms first, but they always intended to reform the political structure. And that's essentially been put on hold for, you know, the past 23 years and counting since 1989. But it needs to take place. So, you know, there's some indication that so Xi Jinping, the heir apparent, the guy who will be, you know, named the Communist Party chief and the army chief at the leadership transition in a month. He met recently with the son of Hu Yaobang, Hu Deping, and they claim that the information that's come out of the meeting is that there's a reform agenda emerging, but it's just so difficult to put through because there are so many vested interests now. So these are going to be some tough years ahead. But structurally, the Chinese economy, everyone recognizes it needs to go through some big changes, just like we do.
Just in closing, Scott Savitt, when the Chinese defense minister, who's standing next to the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, when he says that they hope to resolve this dispute over these islands peacefully, but they reserve the right to take further action if Japan does not correct its mistakes, that sounds like you're asking concessions from the Japanese. It may not happen.
It's for show. I mean, it's for domestic consumption. No Chinese, you know, government or party leader, military leader can afford to look weak in front of their own people. But there's no substance to it. Nothing has changed. And, you know, ultimately, the Chinese position has been that these are all negotiable. And they just prefer to negotiate bilaterally, and the U.S. is basically taking the side that they should be multilateral negotiations with ASEAN and Japan. And anyway, I mean, it's, you know, typical negotiation over a territorial dispute. But I mean, a shooting war, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Guess what? China might not win one. They, you know, this generation, they don't have anyone in their military that has any relevant military experience. They don't even know what would happen if they, you know, they took the covers off. That's the biggest concern of all, really, and the biggest reason why it's not going to happen.
Well, Scott Savitt, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Savitt, who's a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. His forthcoming memoir is on his 2 decades as an American reporter in China. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Show Me Your Papers state, Arizona.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Biggers, the American Book Award-winning author of several books of history and memoir, including The United States of Appalachia in the Sierra Madre and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, which received the Sierra Club's David Brow Award for Environmental Reporting. Raised in Tucson, Arizona, his latest book just out is State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. He writes regularly for Salon and Huffington Post, among other publications, and performs monologues based on his work at theaters and festivals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
And obviously, the federal judge who has been trying to navigate with the Supreme Court, Judge Susan Bolton, over the how to implement the ruling when the Supreme Court struck down most of SB 1070, the remaining part of the law, the Show Me Your Papers provision, as it's called, she had, I think, no choice but to implement it. But even the Supreme Court itself, Justice Kennedy, in his ruling, suggested that we'll just have to wait and see how it's implemented. What's your sense of how it's implemented? Because I just can't see any other way that this law could be implemented, but that it would involve profiling.
Right. Well, let's just look at the empirical evidence, Ian. You know, in December, the Department of Justice announced their investigation of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. And this is just in one county of the rest of the state. Of course, Maricopa County is infamous there in the Phoenix area. They went through thousands of documents, 400 interviews, and they found what they called the worst cases of racial profiling they'd ever seen in their experience. You know, I think it's very clear from the get-go that this is going to create a state of confusion, but also just rampant violations of civil rights. And I think for the most part, everybody was very disappointed at Judge Bolton's decision, but at the same time recognized the sort of the horse before the cart. They have to wait till the law is actually instituted. It came into effect yesterday. But I think there's going to be an avalanche of violations that will quickly be brought back to court. So I think we'll be right back in court very soon.
Well, according to the Justice Department, Jeff Biggers, Arizona's population of 2 million Latinos include an estimated 400,000 who are undocumented. So given that and I'd like to understand why the feds dropped their case against Sheriff Arpaio. So he's free to run amok, isn't he?
Well, they had two cases. What they dropped last week that you're referring to, which also was really a great disappointment, was an investigation into corruption and mismanagement and abuse of power that he had been working with the former county prosecutor who eventually was disbarred for corruption and mismanagement and once again, abuse of power. The feds, for some reason, lost their backbones and dropped that case. But the investigation in terms of racial profiling and civil rights violations, that investigation is still on.
So when you talk about corruption, Jeff Biggers, my understanding is that that a possible subtext for pushing this law through was that many people in Governor Brewer's administration at the highest levels also had either direct involvement with or had connections to the private prison industry, and that this law, SB 1070, fully implemented, would be a boon for private prisons because so many people would be arrested waiting deportation.
Right. You know, there was just an incredible expose on that over a year ago, showing that at one of the conventions of ALEC, of course, you know, the shadowy front of the corporate lobbies and very conservative legislators, they're in the hotel with former state Senator Russell Pierce, who was the architect behind SB 1070. We're the prison lobbyists who worked hand in hand and actually helped come up with some of the language of the bill itself. So it's a matter of fact. They even admit that. And I think that is beyond any kind of cautionary tale. It's something that we really all have to look across the country is, what is the difference now with this attack on immigrants? It's no longer of, let's just get rid of them and deport them, like in the 1950s with Eisenhower. It's no longer, let's create a bigger wall, like Bill Clinton wanted to do, of course, with Operation Gatekeeper. Now we're really looking at a very extreme punitive approach that we want to throw them in prison for a certain amount of time. And then, of course, I think you're really right on where you touch is, therefore, who's benefiting? And the entire prison system that deals with undocumented immigrants is completely controlled now by the private prison industry, which, once again, was hand in step with this law. So I think that's something that should raise the hair on the back of all Americans who not only believe in civil rights, but just believe in the Constitution itself.
Again, I'm speaking with award-winning author Jeff Biggers, whose latest book is State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. So how did Arizona end up with such a constellation of noxious politicians and real sort of crypto fascists like Sheriff Arpaio, Russell Pierce, who's actually suffered political reversal, and Jan Brewer, who's famous for wagging her finger in the face of President Obama. I remember speaking some years back to a reporter with the Arizona Republic. I asked him, I said, "What's with your governor?" And he said, "Oh, don't you realize she's as dumb as a bag of hammers."
Right, that's a compliment. You know, Ian, we've been going through this cycles of anti-immigrant spasms and state rights movements for a century. And as a historian, I had to go back and sort of say, you know, is what's happening now, is it unique? Or is it just follows this continuum of what we've been dealing with? And in fact, if you look at Arizona, it came into the Union 100 years ago. It came kicking and screaming. They didn't want to be part of a state conjoined with New Mexico out of sheer racism. They said New Mexico was a bunch of Mexicans, and Arizona they wanted to keep pure Anglo-American, a complete disregard for the history, for the reality of the cultural legacies and makeup of the state. The good news, though, and I think this is something I really try to stress in my book, is that for 100 years, the deeply rooted part of Arizona, what I call the real Arizona or the other Arizona, has been fighting back. And in fact, it was people like Mexican and immigrant labor, Mexican Americans, who were working in the copper camps that galvanized Arizona as a state and really brought it in as a state in 1912 as a very progressive labor state. Once again, they were booted out and deported. Once again, it was Mexican Americans and immigrants and indigenous people who led all sorts of social and cultural movements for civil rights, you know, up until Cesar Chavez, of course, who came out of Arizona's fields and had to return in 1972 for his great Si Se Puede movement, which ultimately changed how we see migrant workers. So there's been this pushback, pullback, pushback, pullback for 100 years. So while Arizona certainly has its share of Tea Party yahoos and neo-Nazis and all sorts of characters, I think it's also really important to point out that it has its incredible share of real American heroes who've been fighting back against this kind of extremism for over a century.
Well, we certainly learned about people like Gabrielle Giffords after she was shot. You know, what a great champion she is, and the former governor, who's now a Secretary of Homeland Security. There are some impressive politicians, but the questions that Jan Brewer raises is, if she's as dumb as a bag of hammers, who's controlling her?
Right. You know, and clearly it was Russell Pierce. And here's a good example. Russell Pierce, this fringe politician who believes there's been this invasion from Mexico, who's part of this fringy 10th Amendment crowd. Russell Pierce doesn't believe that we're citizens of the United States. We're citizens of the sovereign states of America. And therefore, he's a complete states' rightser, straight out of the 1950s of Alabama. Now, here's this fringy guy who somehow got control of the state Senate, and he became president of our state Senate. And it's he who was essentially the de facto governor and rammed through SB 1070. Brewer knew nothing what was going on. But at the same time, within 6 months of Pierce being at the pinnacle of his power, this man who seemed invincible, the Tea Party president, a movement was started by a young Latino organizer. He worked with a bipartisan coalition. They went block for block in arguably the most conservative district in America, Mesa, the heartland of conservative Mormonism. And they took on Pierce, and they defeated him in a recall. And this, to me, Ian, was the most important national story overlooked by the national media. We all were watching Wisconsin, but we should have been watching Arizona, because this little group of determined people, a mix of young Latinos with, sort of graying baby boomers, came together to say, hey, this extremism doesn't represent Arizona, and they took it to the ballot box, and they actually threw out, for the first time in American history, a sitting state Senate president. And that, to me, is an incredible victory, but more importantly, it's really the opening salvo of what this election and the next elections are going to be about.
And what's your sense, Jeff Biggers, of the whole national election is in flux, it would seem, with a very close race at the presidential level and unprecedented amounts of money being poured in at the state and local level, largely from conservative billionaires through super PACs, to elect Republicans both to the state house and to the Congress. What's the lay of the land like in Arizona?
You know, it's really up for grabs now. Obviously, it's still leaning Romney, but at the same time, the Senate race is neck and neck. You know, the former U.S. Surgeon General under Bush has become a Democrat. His name is Richard Carmona. He's actually a Puerto Rican who has since moved to Arizona. I think this is what I see. The Republican Party, as we saw a couple of weeks ago at their convention, completely embraced the Arizonification of immigration. They went way outright, way out extreme. They even complimented it in Arizona on the states' rights rebellion. You know, they rammed through this immigration platform that was extreme. And Romney has basically tied into that. He's made Arizona a litmus test. And as we know, Ian, there's 15 swing states, especially in the West, that all have critical Latino voterage. And what we also know is that the Latino vote is probably going to increase at least by 8% this year. So if you're looking in those states like Colorado and New Mexico and Arizona and Las Vegas and Nevada and those areas, you know, where often the races are determined by less than 3%, if you see a mobilization of the Latino vote, which I feel like we're going to see this year, they are going to make the difference in the race. You know, every month, Ian, we have 18,000 new Latino voters being registered across the country, new 18-year-olds who are turning voting age. And I think this is part of the demographic shift that the old-timers, these old guard of the Tea Party in Arizona, want to deny. But in fact, this is the reality. This is the reality you're facing in California. This is the reality of demographic shift that's happening now in Arizona, where you have 87% of the population who are older are actually Anglos, whereas 65% of the youth are Latinos. And this is not from immigration. This is just from native births. And so the writing is on the wall, and I think that's what we have to really reflect, is that there's a new Latino power and electorate that I think is really going to come into play as a critical part in this election, and if not in this election, then in 2014 and 2016.
Again, I'm speaking with award-winning author Jeff Biggers, the author of the new book, State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. So back to the implementation of the so-called Show Me Your Papers part of SB 1070, most of which was struck down by the Supreme Court. And as I mentioned, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy in late June warned that the federal law had to could face the new law could face further constitutional challenges. It's going into effect. You're suggesting that Arizona could be a bellwether for the election. So what kind of scenarios are going to play out on the streets? I mean, if you've noticed what Mitt Romney just did with the release of that tape showing his true attitudes, that 47% of Americans, I guess that includes you and me, Jeff, are victims. But he's doubling down on that. He's trying to say that, you know, I'm making a larger point, and I'm, you know, he's using his own gaffe as a wedge issue. So it's not inconceivable that the Republicans will use the immigration issue as a wedge issue. So the real question is, what kind of pictures are we going to be seeing on television? I understand a lot of young activists are now warning Latinos in Arizona not to carry any papers, any ID with them. But on the other hand, you know, I'm sure that Romney and the Republicans would love to see pictures of Sheriff Arpaio's coming in on a horse and ridding the country of interlopers.
Right, and I think that's it's going to be a tremendous burden on the media on how they present that. I think you're very right that this can become a wedge issue no different than, you know, homophobia or a wedge issue like abortion. But on the other hand, I think the polls suggest that the majority of Americans support the DREAM Act and DREAMers. The fact that young Americans who have been here since they were brought as young children and have grown up here have a right to become American citizens and contribute in some way. I think nationally, the polls show that people don't believe in this kind of punitive approach. You know, they immediately did it copycat in Georgia. They did a copycat in Alabama. And suddenly they lost all their workers. And so you have these huge corporate farms, Ian, who you would think that would have been on the side of the conservative government, who are saying, hey, wait a minute, we have just lost all of our pickers of sweet potatoes and onions and garlic. The fields, you know, were completely collapsing. And that sort of reality of the contributions of immigrants, whether they are documented or not, I think is beginning to be reflected. At the same time, I think the media is going to play an incredible role, just like it did in the 1960s. If they show mothers being yanked out of factories, yanked out of hotels, leaving behind children. We have over 5,000 children in foster care alone whose parents are incarcerated now just because they're undocumented. You know, do Americans tolerate that? Do Americans feel like that's just? Is that part of the American dream? I don't think so. I think that's going to backfire in any kind of extremist Republican agenda, because I think ultimately people realize, you know, immigrants benefit, that America is best seen through the eyes of immigration. That's why they've come to our country. And I think the facts also bear out. You know, I moved to Arizona, for example, in 1970 when the coal fields collapsed where my family was from. 40 years later, the immigration rates and the crime rates are lower than they were in the 1970s. And this is something that has been completely lost in all this political banter, that in fact, in the immigrant neighborhoods, we have the lowest crime rates, that in fact, the immigration, we don't have this kind of invasion that we've been talking about. And I think once we get the facts on the table, we get the human stories on the table, we get the history on the table, I think for the most part, the majority of the Americans are going to see that they're going to reject this extremism just as they are right now in Arizona.
Well, just in the last minute, though, Jeff, it would seem that the relationship between the immigrant communities and the police are absolutely would break down if they haven't already broken down. And a lot of more intelligent police than Arpaio were saying this is a terrible law because we need the trust of the community and people won't come to us. We can't police a neighborhood. So you're going to have more distrust between the community and the police, and you're also going to have more of these hideous raids where children are separated from their parents who are dragged off and suddenly they're in foster care. I mean, that's going to happen more often, isn't it, in the next, you know, starting today, right?
Yeah, and I think that's, we're waiting to see what really happens. I think you're right. There is a real emergence of what we call barrio defense committees that are watchdogs now for any sort of law enforcement agencies. And think of the insanity of that. Instead of seeing law enforcement agencies as your friends who are going to be helping you, as you say, now they're no longer going to be cooperating. The real criminals now will be free to roam because nobody will be there to work with the police to go after people who, in fact, need to be policed. I think it's going to create, you know, the Center for American Progress did an amazing report about a year ago, and they called it a state of confusion. You know, we're talking beyond Maricopa County that has, you know, already documented thousands of cases of racial profiling. We're talking about the rest of the state, small town local cops, city cops, county cops, state troopers, federal cops. You know, just think of how many versions of this law are going to take place, truly. You know, they're going to see someone, and they're going to say, I've stopped this person. Do I have the right to ask him if he's reasonably suspicious, and what really does that mean? And let's just finish with what does that mean. Sheriff Joe Arpaio went on to Glenn Beck a couple of years. And Glenn Beck, of course, no friend of this issue, asked him. He said, Joe, what does it mean if someone's reasonably suspicious? And Joe responded, Sheriff Joe said, some people, and I'm reading this from the transcripts, some people who have an erratic or scared or whatever, if they have their speech or whatever they look like, if they come from another country, we'll take care of that situation. And Glenn Beck, you know, as right-wing as you're going to get, actually mocked Sheriff Arpaio and said, Sheriff, this sounds like racial profiling. And if Glenn Beck can see the racial profiling, then you'd think that the courts and the systems and the public themselves are going to see it within a very short time.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks for having me, and always a pleasure. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Biggers, who's the American Book Award-winning author of several books on history and memoir, including The United States of Appalachia, In the Sierra Madre, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, which received the Sierra Club's David Brower Award for Environmental Reporting. Raised in Tucson, Arizona, his latest book just out is The State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. He writes regularly for Salon.com and the Huffington Post and performs monologues based on his work at theaters and festivals. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of The End of Men and the Rise of Women.
Time to send someone away. Got my back covered. Said, how you been all led astray? Come, let's count, it's absurd. They lead you to the race where no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Hannah Rosen, a senior editor at The Atlantic and founder of Double X, Slate's women's section. She has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, GQ, The New Republic, and The Washington Post, and is the recipient of the 2010 National Magazine Award. Her latest book just out is The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hannah Rosen.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And so we're experiencing the twilight of the patriarchy, I understand. And I'm wondering whether Rick Santorum, Paul Ryan, and Mitt Romney know about it.
They probably don't know about it. That's a really good point. And I also like your poetic phrase. That would have made a better book title, perhaps.
Well, it's interesting, though, isn't it, to compare those three gentlemen with the current incumbent in the White House and the last Democrat, both of whom came out of a matriarchal situation largely, didn't they, in terms of their childhood?
Yes, that's a very good point. And actually, when I was listening to their visions of family at the two conventions, you really did see a completely different picture. So in Ann Romney's speech, for example, she gave a vision of a very traditional family life, even though a lot of Republican voters, in fact, are not that person. I mean, a lot of red state voters are in a situation where they're less likely to get married, more likely to have children alone. And so, but yet the appeal they make is a very traditional appeal.
And your book, The End of Women and the End of Men and the Rise of Women, Hannah Rosen, focuses on the United States and on how much the new service economy has brought about this new phenomenon. One of the most I think, clear statistics that support your argument is that the average wife today contributes some 42.2% of the family income, up sharply from the 2 to 6% that women contributed in the 1970s. That's a pretty profound change.
Yes, I mean, one amazing thing about reporting the book, which grew out of a magazine story, is I started out thinking about this as a largely economic phenomenon, you know, having to do with changes in the economy, moving towards a service and information economy. But in the couple of years since I've been researching it, I realized how deeply it's seeped into so much of how we live now, about, you know, decisions we make about marriage, about raising our children, about dating lives, you know, even our violence patterns. I mean, it really has changed a lot of American life and life in other countries, although it manifests itself differently in different countries. I have a chapter on Korea in the book, for example, which is an extremely patriarchal society, but has all this sort of budding, you know, women are moving so quickly in that society, it's really shaking things up.
Well, we actually started out talking about China and the idea that China and Japan, the world's second and third largest economies, could go to war over some desolate islands. China, of course, has always favored the male child, and I guess that goes back to Confucianism.
Yes. I mean, the Asian societies, I mean, China's a different case because it has a one-child policy, and actually the Asian societies are very erratic on this question. So in some, you see sort of heavy favoritism towards the male child. And then you have these great statistics being kept on Korea, which is the country I focus on, in which that preference has now shifted so that families are saying they'd rather have a girl, and that's only shifted in the last decade or so.
Well, what made me think about China and favoring the male child is the notion that the growing hegemon in the world today is going to be run by a bunch of spoiled brats.
Are you talking about the Chinese?
The Chinese princelings were grown up. They brought up in a culture where they were worshipped.
Right.
Could do no wrong.
Right. 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 No, that is a very good point. That's a whole other dynamic of worship of the firstborn. You know, the Chinese son.
But let's continue on though on the United States here, because in terms of the end of men and the rise of women. The point being is that this has largely happened because of a social collapse resulting from the evisceration of the manufacturing base and putting so many men out of work.
That's where it starts. I mean, you see that, you know, it used to be perfectly possible to have a prosperous middle-class life if you worked in a manufacturing industry. And I have one of my chapters was reported entirely in a manufacturing town in Alabama in which people were living quite good lives with, you know, a little bit of education and a little engineering degree. And suddenly you see you can't do that anymore. I mean, that doesn't work as a way of entering the middle class. And so a lot of those men effectively got left behind in the new era. We haven't quite figured out what the post-manufacturing era is, and men are having a harder time adapting, basically, while women are having an easier time. So that basically means going to college, getting the credentials and degrees you need in order to meet whatever the economy throws your way.
Well, just a statistic here that since 2000, the manufacturing economy has lost 6 million jobs, a third of its total workforce, most of it male. And in 1950, 1 in 20 men in their prime were not working. Today, the number is a terrifying 1 in 5.
Yes, I mean, a lot of economists describe that as, you know, the great social catastrophe, because as you can imagine, it has a lot of social ramifications, which is basically that, you know, men then sort of drop out of civil society. We've seen it happen before in American culture, and they don't live with their families. They're not necessarily supporting their families. They kind of lose a sense of purpose and leadership, and that's not really good for anybody.
Again, I'm speaking with Hannah Rosen, a senior editor at The Atlantic and founder of XX, Slate's Women's Sections. She's the author of the new book just out, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. So let's talk about the new matriarchy and particularly the poor and middle class manifestation of it. And obviously, I don't know that there is a 1% matriarchy. I know Ann Romney did her best to try and portray herself as being an ordinary housewife, but just to concentrate on particularly on the poor, the notion that we have so many women that are working and having jobs and raising children alone without the male, and in a sense, if the man can't pull his weight, he's just another mouth to feed.
Yes, that's a phrase that's extremely insulting, and yet one that I heard over and over again from women. I mean, one of the images that stuck with me from reporting the book is this image of a woman in a community college who falls asleep between the first floor and the eighth floor because, like many women in community college, she's raising children, she's holding a job, she's getting an education so she can get a slightly better job. An MIT economist called it the last one holding the bag theory, meaning the woman is the last one holding the bag, that she's not necessarily working because she wants to or because she's on a great feminist crusade. She's working because somebody has to do it. I mean, that somebody has to feed the children. So everywhere I go across the country, you see this dynamic taking hold and destabilizing. We recently passed the 50% of children born to mothers under 30 are born to single mothers. That is, you know, or unmarried mothers rather, and that's because of this phenomenon I described, because the women are essentially choosing not to marry the men and instead to go it alone.
Well, I have a millennial daughter who's in medical school, and most of her class, or certainly the majority of her class, are women. And I believe that's true as well in law schools, although I'm not sure we need any more lawyers. But tell me about hookup culture with today's young women, because it's always been, the man has always been portrayed in popular culture and literature as the protagonist in romance,
yes.
Not to mention sex.
Yes. Well, your daughter could probably help us on this one, but I have a slightly different take on it. It's perhaps my most controversial chapter, which is that women are almost always portrayed exclusively as victims in this new culture. And for those who don't know what it is, it's essentially a way of having intimate relationships without a long-term commitment. So hookup is the shorthand we use for that. And often we say, you know, that's the man's world, that's the ultimate male fantasy, isn't that what all men want? And thanks to these researchers who I talked to had spent 4 years in this college camped out in the storm, what they found was that, in fact, women were avoiding getting into long-term relationships, that at that moment in their lives, they were very much focused on their careers and establishing themselves, and so the hookup culture essentially allowed them to have some kind of emotional intimacy, and we're not talking about one-night stands, but we are talking about ways to have relationships without necessarily being completely tied down. And I have to say, of all the parts of my books, that's the most I've heard from young women, is them basically writing me letters and telling me, look, we have invented these new forms of things. You know, it's not that we love one-night stands or we don't have a lot of complaints about the hookup culture, but we are inventing these new things that are somewhere between headed towards marriage and one-night stands.
So it's not necessarily that these women have hearts of steel.
Yeah, I mean, in the chapter, I basically follow one girl throughout, and she starts out in kind of everybody's caricature of a girl in the hookup culture, which we've actually seen in movies these days. There's a movie, Bachelorette, which came out this month, and, you know, trash-talking, like, vulgar, like, you know, the kind of women who you listen to her talk and you think, oh, my gosh. But then by the end of the chapter, you watch her move through the culture until she's getting engaged. So you see that, you know, like most American women, this is the phase that they go through. College-educated women are still extremely likely to get married eventually, and so this is the phase they seem to go through in their 20s and 30s.
So she ends up remembering his name in the morning.
Exactly, and marrying him.
Oh my God.
For sure.
So tell me, Anna Rosen, about successful women. I mentioned a lot of the book focuses on the new emerging matriarchy in poor and middle class America, but you do have examples of successful women in the Silicon Valley.
Yes, that's a different set of, you know, one thing when people ask, they read the title of the book and they say, oh, what about leadership? You know, why don't we see more women in leadership, which is a perfectly, completely valid question. And so I try and workshop kind of what happens at the top and what prevents women from getting through. And the reason I chose Silicon Valley for the book is because that's the one that economists say has figured out a slightly new way for women to be ambitious and still be present in their families. And it largely has to do with flexibility and the idea idea that they don't have any preconceived notions of how a workplace has to be, unlike, say, Wall Street or law firms, you know, who count by the hour. Silicon Valley allows women to come up with these fairly creative arrangements. So they work like mad. I mean, they're working all day and all night. They're working all the time. It's not necessarily the life anyone would choose, but it does allow them to keep a foot in both worlds and makes them quite happy. So I just use them as a model for the emerging creative American marketplace as we would like it to be if we truly want to succeed.
So it's not exactly commonplace. The example where Google persuaded a woman at Google persuaded her boss to fly her child and her nanny with her around the world on business class.
I know. I thought that was amazing. She told me that she basically presented them the spreadsheet of exactly how much it would cost them to hire a new employee and train a new employee to do her job. She'd been quite good at it, and she'd been doing it for a number of years, and then presented, and then compared that to how much it would cost to fly her nanny and child, to all of her international destinations, and she was right. It was cheaper to fly her nanny and child, so that's what they did. You can't imagine that happening in too many workplaces, just as you can't imagine when Marissa Mayer of Google became the CEO of Yahoo. You can't quite imagine, and she was visibly pregnant when she was chosen as CEO and said that she wasn't going to take any maternity leave. Now, that's not really a viable model for most women. Most women want to take some form of maternity leave, but on the other hand, I'm happy that new models like that exist, that we can see such a thing. We can wonder what her husband's going to do or help out with the baby, and that they exist for women to look up to, even if they don't want to exactly do that themselves.
So, Hannah Rosen, the book also deals with women in the military, in as much as women now as warriors, even though ostensibly they haven't been given combat roles, but in this new form of warfare, the lines are very blurred, and we know that women have actually been in combat.
Right.
It's interesting. A few years ago, I went to Denmark to do some research on a screenplay I was writing about Niels Bohr, the nuclear scientist in Denmark, Nazi-occupied Denmark during the war, who the Allies desperately wanted to get out because of his knowledge about atomic physics. And he ended up getting to Los Alamos and working on the first atomic bomb. And he was spirited out of the country by the Danish underground at the time when they got all of the Danish Jews out to Sweden. Uh-huh. So I met with a lot of Danish underground people who had been involved with Niels Bohr and in the war. And they, without exception, they all told me that in the underground, the most deadly people of all were the women. They were the best assassins. I was absolutely blown away.
That's so interesting. I have a section in there about violence, of course, in the book, because I was flabbergasted myself when you look at the numbers of how much more and different kinds of female violence there is these days. And one of my asides in that chapter is about female suicide bombers. And we have always, conjectured that the reason there are more women suicide bombers, we sort of attribute all these emotional stories to them, and maybe their husband was killed. But it turns out they're just a lot more lethal. They're better at it. They hide things better.
Right. I'm sorry to stop you here, Anna, but we're out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I mean, speaking with Hannah Rosen, the senior editor of The Atlantic and founder of XXX Slate's Women's Section. She's the author of a new book just out, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. This has been Background Brief. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.